Hi, I'm Jackie Roble with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. During the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information from the Nutrition Action Health Letter. Nutrition Action Health Letter is the flagship publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest. Published 10 times a year, Nutrition Action provides honest, unbiased, science-based advice on nutrition and health. It's the world's largest circulation nutrition newsletter, bringing the latest nutrition news and advice to more than 500,000 readers. Nutrition Action is totally free of advertisings, so we're free to blow the whistle on products that aren't what they pretend to be, and to applaud the good ones. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. The following articles are from the March edition of the Nutrition Action Health Letter. The first article in Nutrition Action Health Letter is a memo from Peter G. Lurie, MD, MPH, and President for Center for Science in the Public Interest. Tracking trends. It's no secret why the Center for Science in the Public Interest, Nutrition Action's publisher, has spent the last 20 years fighting to get trans fat out of the food supply. Partially hydrogenated oil, the source of artificial trans fat, has been around for more than a century. But it wasn't until the early 1990s that studies produced unequivocal evidence linking it to heart disease in humans. Not only does just a small amount of trans fat raise LDL, or bad cholesterol, it also lowers HDL, or good cholesterol. In 1994, we formally urged the Food and Drug Administration to list trans fat on nutrition facts labels, and a decade later, we asked the FDA to ban partially hydrogenated oil entirely. Meanwhile, we used lab tests and lawsuits to push restaurants to switch to trans-free cooking oils. Our work has borne fruit. In 2006, trans fat was added to nutrition facts labels, and in 2015, the FDA finalized a ban on partially hydrogenated oil that goes into effect this June. As a result, most artificial trans fat is already out of the food supply. All well and good, but has getting rid of trans fat made people healthier? By all accounts, yes. In 2004, Denmark became the first country to virtually eliminate artificial trans fat. During the first 3 years following the ban, researchers estimated heart disease deaths dropped by 4.3% more than they would have with no ban. Had the researchers waited longer, they might have seen an even greater benefit. But in 2007, Denmark enacted anti-smoking laws. Since smoking raises heart disease risk, it would have become much harder to tease out the trans ban impact on death rates after the smoking restrictions were in place. A 4.3% reduction might sound modest, but it meant that roughly 770 fewer Danes died of heart disease per year. That's more than the number of Danes killed in traffic accidents each year. In 2007, New York became the first major U.S. city to ban more than trivial amounts of artificial trans fat in restaurants. Some, but not all, counties in New York State soon followed suit. Within 3 years, according to a 2017 study, hospital admissions for heart attacks and strokes had dropped by 6.2% more in counties with bans than in counties without bans. That would have translated into some 87,500 fewer heart attacks and strokes nationwide over those 3 years, just from getting trans out of restaurants. An earlier study credited the New York trans ban with a 4.5% reduction in deaths from heart disease, which could translate into roughly 40,200 fewer deaths nationwide per year. Despite the caveats, the studies weren't designed to show cause and effect. Something other than the trans ban could have explained the differences between New York counties, and what happens in New York State may not reflect what would happen in, say, Iowa. It looks like getting rid of trans has been a rousing public health success. It seems pretty clear that Americans will reap the benefits for years to come. Seeing Through the News by Bonnie Liebman. Another day, another study. The media can't resist reporting the latest diet and health news, no matter how preliminary. Many reporters only read a press release about a study. They can't tell how solid it is or if better studies disagree. If it's clickworthy, it's news. Vitamin B6 and B12 supplements appear to cause cancer in men. If you're not taking vitamin B12, forget about having energy, the Atlantic article facetiously explained. And if you want to supercharge your metabolism and energy levels, Amazon can deliver you a tall bottle of B12 supplements by the end of the day. Kudos to the Atlantic for skewering the baseless energy and metabolism claims used to sell B vitamins. But the study that led The Atlantic to declare that B vitamins appear to cause cancer in men doesn't hold a candle to far better evidence that B vitamins, even at high doses, don't cause cancer. The new study found that men, but not women, who reported taking vitamins B6 and B12 at higher doses than typically found in a multi, had a higher risk of lung cancer. But a single study of that kind can't prove cause and effect, since something else about the vitamin takers could explain their higher risk. In contrast, randomized controlled trials can prove cause and effect. And in 2010, researchers examined 8 trials that gave large doses of B vitamins to more than 37,000 people at risk for heart attack and stroke, typically for 5 years. All 8 trials tested folic acid, 7 also tested B12, and 6 tested B6. The difference in overall cancer rates between B vitamins and placebo takers? Zip. In 2013, researchers looked at 13 trials, including 10 that tested B12 or B6, on nearly 50,000 people. Again, they saw no difference in cancers and the lung, breast, prostate, colon, or other organs. Bottom line, don't expect B vitamins to boost your energy, your metabolism, or your risk of cancer. Study challenges conventional wisdom on fats, fruits, and vegetables. Global dietary guidelines should possibly be changed to allow people to consume somewhat more fats, to cut back on carbohydrates, and in some cases to slightly scale back on fruits and vegetables, a large study suggests, Reuters reported in August. Really? The study sounded impressive. The new data are drawn from the Prospective Urban-Rural Epidemiology, or PURE, study, which recruited people ages 35 to 70 in 18 countries, said Reuters. That's 135,335 people who were followed for 7 years. One problem. Most of the 18 countries were low income, like Bangladesh, India, and Zimbabwe, or middle income, like China, Malaysia, and Turkey. With only 3 high income countries, Canada, Sweden, and the United Arab Emirates, you have to wonder, does that mean we should eat more fats and fewer carbs? The PURE participants who got 77% of their calories from carbs were more likely to die during the study than those who got 45%, but Americans average 48%, which puts us roughly in PURE's less likely to die group. Likewise, the PURE participants who got 11% of their calories from fat were more likely to die than those who got 35%. Americans average 34% of calories from fat, so again, we're hitting PURE's lowest risk spot. The bigger question is, who were the PURE participants who got 77% of their calories from carbs and only 11% from fat? Were they subsisting largely on white rice? Were they unable to afford other foods? If so, what do the PURE results have to do with Americans, who are at risk not from impoverished rice diets, but from meat lovers' pizza, bacon cheeseburger, loaded fries diets? The authors don't say what the high-carb, low-fat eaters were more likely to die of, other than it was not cardiovascular disease, the leading killer of Americans. And who knows what the curious results on fruits and vegetables mean? Our findings show the lowest risk of death was among people who ate 3 to 4 servings with little additional benefit beyond that range, a study author told Reuters. However, she added, we don't want to tell people who are eating more than the recommendation to eat less. Glad to hear it. Bottom line? Ignore studies about people whose diets are vastly different than ours. Vitamin D and calcium don't prevent bone fractures. Vitamin D and calcium supplements are widely used for the prevention of bone fractures in older adults, but a large analysis confirms earlier reports they do not work, declared the online edition of the New York Times in December. Whoa! In one terse 9-sentence article with hardly a caveat, the Times reported on a meta-analysis, a compilation of earlier trials, not a large new one, as if it were an end-of-discussion, nail-in-the-coffin finding. The LA Times and some others were more cautious. Calcium and vitamin D supplements may not protect against bone fractures, reported the Washington Post. Even the print edition of the New York Times had a more nuanced headline. In fact, the results of a meta-analysis aren't as cut and dry as they may seem. A key question? Which studies to include? For example, did it make sense for the new meta-analysis to exclude a large trial on nursing home residents? Calcium plus vitamin D lowered the risk of fractures in that trial. What about a trial in which nearly half of the women in the placebo group were taking calcium and vitamin D on their own? Or a trial in which more than a third of the participants stopped taking their calcium and vitamin D after 2 years? Both stayed in. Doing a meta-analysis is easy. Translating the often imperfect body of evidence into advice for the public is hard. So far, the best advice from the National Osteoporosis Foundation and others is to take a calcium and vitamin D supplement only if you get too little. Bottom line, take a supplement only if you get considerably less than the recommended daily allowance for calcium or vitamin D. Is cheese really good for the heart now? Cheese may be the latest food to be transferred from the bad to the good list in recent years, opined the article in Forbes. What prompted that news? A team of researchers from China and the Netherlands looked back over data from 15 earlier studies, which together included over 200,000 participants, explained Forbes. Sounds impressive, but like any meta-analysis, what comes out is only as good as what goes in. Some of the 15 studies were under-adjusted. That is, they ignored smoking, weight, exercise, history of heart disease, diet, drugs, and other factors that could affect risk. Others were just over-adjusted. For example, some essentially compared people with the same blood cholesterol levels, which would wipe away any impact of cheese on risk. Nevertheless, the studies all got thrown into the same pot. The results of the meta-analysis, a little cheese isn't linked to heart disease or stroke. In fact, it may even be linked to a risk reduction for both, reported Forbes. That must have pleased the three study co-authors who work for Yili, a giant Chinese dairy company. Last year, Yili toyed with the idea of buying Stonyfield. Forbes forgot to mention that link. So did Time and Cooking Light. Nor did Forbes mention that many of the other studies it cited, all with good news about cheese, were funded by the dairy industry. Oops. To its credit, Forbes did note several caveats about the meta-analysis. For Forbes, bottom line should please Yili. Cheese in modest amounts may join the likes of butter, coffee, dark chocolate, and eggs in losing their unhealthy status. That's just what readers and the dairy industry want to hear. Bottom line, replace some cheese and other foods that are rich in saturated fat with soy, fish, nuts, and other foods that are rich in unsaturated fats. Fat Fears. Does Cooking Make Your Oil Dangerous? By Caitlin Dow. Olive oil, due to its chemical structure, is susceptible to oxidative damage when heated, says thekitchenskinny.com. When it comes to high-heat cooking, coconut oil is your best choice, says healthline.com. Befuddled about which oil to use? Here's one expert that clears up the confusion. Coconut oil is the best oil you can use for cooking because it can resist heat-induced damage so you can avoid ingesting oxidized fats, says Mercola.com. Oxidative stress, that is, an excess of free radicals caused by oxidation, may damage DNA and raise the risk of cancer, heart disease, and other illnesses. But your oil is unlikely to become oxidized in the frying pan or wok. For the amount of time you're going to cook and the temperatures you're going to get to, your oil is not going to undergo oxidation, explains Eric Decker, an oil expert and chair of the Department of Food Sciences at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. What's more, adds Decker, every oil naturally contains vitamin E, which is an antioxidant. Extra virgin olive oil has another plus. It isn't refined, so it has a lot of naturally occurring antioxidants. Decker's take-home message? Don't worry about oxidizing oils in your stovetop. If you're just pan frying, no oxidation probably occurs. Even with deep fat frying at home, oxidation is minimal. So fear of frying is no reason to stop using monounsaturated oils, olive oil, peanut, canola, or polyunsaturated oils such as soy, corn, or sunflower. Switch lower LDL, or bad cholesterol, and switch to coconut oil, which raises LDL. Some oils do hold up better at temperatures, though. Any oil starts to degrade once it reaches its smoke point, which varies from oil to oil. If you put oil in the pan and heat it too much or let it go too long, the oil starts smoking, Decker says, and then you could be in trouble. The smoke point is followed by the flash point, notes Decker. That's when your oil catches on fire. If you accidentally let your oil smoke, get rid of it and start over. Refining an oil raises its smoke point by removing impurities, which is why refined oils, like most canola, soy, and peanut, as well as light or pure olive oil, work well for high-temperature cooking. Do oils ever become oxidized? Yes, but it's easy to tell when that happens. When oxidation occurs, the fatty acid breaks into small molecules, which have a smell, says Decker. That's what we call rancidity. But a high temperature isn't the biggest cause of oxidation, says Decker. It's time. I just cringe when I see people buying 5-gallon containers of soybean oil, because there's no way, unless they're deep frying every day, they're going to use it up before it goes rancid. While all oils can become oxidized, the more unsaturated the fat is, the more susceptible it is, adds Decker. What to do? Buy smaller bottles and store them in the refrigerator, says Decker. That's what I do at home, and if your oil smells bad, don't use it. There's no need to keep olive oil cold, though. It will harden in the refrigerator, says Decker. Plus, it's more stable than polyunsaturated fats, so you can keep it at room temperature. The bottom line? For home cooking, almost any oil should be fine. Coconut oil? For your heart's sake, leave it on the shelf. Quick studies. A snapshot of the latest research on diet and exercise. Brain training? Young or old, intense exercise may help keep your brain in good working order. Researchers assigned 27 sedentary people to high-intensity interval training, or HIIT, or sedentary control group. Roughly half were age 18 to 30, and half were age 65 to 80. For 3 days a week, the HIIT group rode a stationary bike for 4 4-minute intervals at high intensity, 90% of their peak aerobic capacity, separated by 3-minute rest periods. On 2 other days each week, they walked on a treadmill for 45 minutes at 70% of their peak. After 12 weeks, glucose uptake in the brain increased more in the HIIT group. Glucose is the brain's primary fuel. The increase occurred in brain regions where uptake declines in people with Alzheimer's disease. Of course, it's not clear that a boost in uptake would prevent Alzheimer's. What to do? Get moving. Although this study tested HIIT, any exercise may help. And try bumping up your effort for a minute or two as you walk, bike, or whatever. That should make your muscles, if not your mind, more fit. Go greens. Greeny leafy vegetables may keep you sharp as you age. Researchers tracked 960 people aged 58 to 99 for an average of 5 years. Those who reported eating the most leafy greens, typically 1 1/3 servings a day, did better on cognitive tests than those who ate the least, typically 3 servings a month. One serving was a cup of salad greens or a half cup of cooked spinach, kale, collards, etc. What to do? It's worth loading up on leafy greens even though a single study of this kind can't prove cause and effect. The researchers took education, smoking, exercise, cognitive activities, alcohol, depression, and other factors into account, but something else about people who eat or don't eat greens may explain the results. Nevertheless, leafy greens are packed with vitamins, minerals, and lutein, and other phytochemicals that may protect your health, and they're delish. March's dish of the month, in fact, is tossed sesame salad. Whisk together 1 tablespoon reduced sodium soy sauce, 1 tablespoon grapeseed oil, 1 tablespoon rice vinegar, 1 teaspoon toasted sesame oil, 1 teaspoon honey, and 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt. Toss with 4 cups salad greens and 3 cups shredded veggies like cabbage, carrots, and radishes. Sitting and belly fat. The time you spend in a chair, on the sofa, or in a car may affect the size of your belly. Scientists did MRI scans of 124 people at risk for type 2 diabetes. Each wore an accelerometer for a week. Among those who were inactive, they averaged 13 minutes a day of at least moderate intensity exercise. Each hour of sedentary time per day was linked to an extra 1.9 quarts of abdominal fat. Sedentary time wasn't linked to belly fat in people who were active. They averaged 40 minutes a day. What to do? Although this type of study on its own can't prove that sitting on the couch boosts belly fat, it's one more reason to get out of your seat. Sleep Hygiene 101. Avoid caffeine. It can take 8 hours to wear off. Limit alcohol at night. You may fall asleep faster, but alcohol cuts the time you spend dreaming and in deep sleep. Unplug. Avoid bright lights, the phone, the computer or tablet, and a TV for an hour before bed. Set bedroom boundaries. No eating, reading, TV viewing, etc. Reduce noise. Avoid falling asleep to music or the TV. If necessary, use a white noise machine or a fan for soothing sounds. Stick to a schedule. Aim for a regular bedtime and rising time. Avoid naps after 3 p.m. Adopt a routine. A regular pre-bedtime routine helps the brain recognize that it's time to go to sleep. Avoid big meals late at night. They may cause indigestion. Try a hot bath before bed. Afterwards, your body temperature drops. That may trigger sleep. Keep the bedroom cool. Check your meds. Some medicines for coughs, colds, or allergies can keep you up. Got jet lag? You can't get rid of jet lag altogether. It typically takes 1 day per time zone traveled for your internal clock to adjust. But these tips may help ease the transition. During the flight, drink lots of water and avoid alcohol and caffeine. Try to eat in-flight meals in line with your destination time. Upon arrival, take a 30-minute nap if you feel tired. Eat meals in line with local time. For eastward travel, each night of 3 nights before your flight, go to bed an hour earlier than normal. At your destination, try to get early morning light. Take melatonin, 1/2 to 5 milligrams, 30 minutes before local bedtime until you have adjusted. For westward travel, each night for 3 nights before your flight, go to bed an hour later than normal. At your destination, try to get late afternoon light. Take melatonin, 1/2 to 5 milligrams, 30 minutes before local bedtime until you've adjusted. Gotcha! Don't fall for tricky meat and poultry claims, by Lindsay Moyer and Jennifer Urban. It's no secret that Americans need to cut back on meat. While we now eat more chicken than beef, we still eat too much red meat, especially beef. That's bad news for our health and for the planet. People who eat more red meat, especially processed meat, have a higher risk of colon cancer, heart disease, and stroke. And it doesn't help that misleading information about meat or poultry can trick even the most careful shoppers. Here's what to watch out for. White meat? According to scientists, red meat means beef, lamb, veal, and yes, pork, despite decades of ads plugging the other white meat. Veal is the meat of young cows that have been made virtually anemic, which gives their flesh a lighter color. You are better off replacing red meats with chicken, turkey, or seafood. Ground chicken or turkey? Ground chicken or ground turkey could mean you're getting meat plus fatty skin and who knows how much of the fattier wings or thighs. Want less fat? Stick with ground chicken breast or ground turkey breast. All natural? It sounds good, but means little. Natural meat or poultry has no artificial ingredients or added colors and is no more than minimally processed. But natural tells you nothing about how the animal was raised, for example, or whether it got antibiotics. Organic? A USDA organic seal means that the animals were given no antibiotics, no hormones, only organic feed, grown without pesticides and not genetically modified, and that they had at least some access to the outdoors. It doesn't guarantee the strongest animal welfare standards, though. No antibiotics? Using antibiotics to make animals grow faster and prevent disease helps the industry's bottom line, but over time it may make those antibiotics useless when people need them to fight off deadly bacteria. So look for raised without antibiotics or no antibiotics ever on the label. Both are stronger than no growth-promoting antibiotics. The FDA has banned that use, yet the claim appears on turkey sold by Shady Brook Farms and Honeysuckle White. Both companies still use antibiotics to treat or prevent illness. Not all antibiotics claims are independently verified, so look for a USDA process verified seal next to the claim, or buy organic. And now a recipe from the healthy cook, Kate Sherwood. Use thinly sliced or pounded chicken that's about 1/4 inch thick. Blotting the chicken dry before sautéing helps it brown. Creamy mushroom and leek chicken serves 4. It's about 3 ounces cooked chicken with sauce, calories 250, total fat 12 grams. The list of contents is 2 tablespoons extra virgin olive oil, divided, 1 pound chicken breast cutlets, 1 leek, white and palest green part only, thinly sliced, 1/4 pound white mushrooms, sliced, 1 teaspoon fresh thyme leaves, 1/2 cup no salt added chicken broth, 1/4 teaspoon kosher salt, 1/2 teaspoon Worcestershire sauce, 1/4 cup low-fat sour cream, 1 tablespoon whole grain mustard. The steps. Heat 1 tablespoon of the oil in a large pan over medium heat until shimmering hot. Sauté the chicken until lightly browned, 3 to 4 minutes. Turn and sauté until cooked through, 1 to 2 minutes. Transfer to a warm serving plate. Add the remaining 1 tablespoon of oil to the pan. Add the leeks, mushrooms, and thyme. Cook stirring often until the vegetables are tender, 2 to 3 minutes. Add the broth and simmer until reduced by half, 1 to 2 minutes. Remove from the heat. Stir in the remaining ingredients. Spoon over the chicken. Enjoy. Right stuff. It's the most famous mango you've never heard of. Honey mangoes are small golden oblongs, about half the size of traditional mangoes, with smooth velvety flesh and a couple of secrets. Secret 1, they're typically sweeter and more succulent than other mango varieties. Secret 2, you can remove their delicate skin with a vegetable peeler. And slicing off pieces around the thin oval pit is easier than removing the sometimes fibrous flesh around an ordinary mango pit. If you don't see honey mangoes, they're also called champagne, manila, or atolfo at your local market. Try a grocer like Whole Foods. Can't find honeys? No worries. All mango varieties are delish, and just 1 cup chopped delivers around 65% of 1 day's vitamin C, 20% of a day's folate, 10% of a day's vitamin A, 5% of a day's potassium, and 3 grams of fiber, all for 100 calories. That's a pretty sweet deal. You'll know your honey mango is ripe when the skin turns deep golden yellow and starts to wrinkle just slightly. It will yield to a gentle squeeze, and the sweet aroma from the stem end may be the best thing you'll smell all day. Buy a few, or a case, to save yourself the hassle of running back to the store after you taste your first one. Peak season is March to June. What, you're still home? Quick tip. To keep your bananas from ripening too fast, wrap the stem end of the bunch tightly in plastic wrap. Even better, separate the bunch and wrap each stem individually. Beyond arm's length. Want a snack less? Keep them out of reach. Researchers randomly assigned 246 adults to sit at a large coffee table with a glass bowl of M&Ms either 8 inches or 2 1/3 feet away during a 10-minute relaxation break between 2 cognitive tests. Roughly 70% of those near the bowl, but only 58% of those farther from the bowl, took some M&Ms. What to do? When it comes to unhealthy snacks, distance is your friend. That's all the time we have for Nutrition News. Until next time, I'm Jackie Robel for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This program is readily available as a podcast after the initial broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.